This is Dick Hain, and this session is Public Policy as a Spiritual Discipline with a particular focus on the Harvest of Peace Resolution, or the Peace Dividend. I'm going to show the videotape, back up, say some things, and go from there. We're catching a woman in the middle of explaining that the tape has three parts. And you can use one or two or three.
Special Hunger and Militarism. This is followed by an interview with Art Simon on the Harvest of Peace Resolution.
Which we won't see here, but if you want to see it sometime, you can.
On why people of faith need to bring these issues before members of Congress.
You can
use
this video in its
entirety and in those sessions which are appropriate for your audience.
We're just going to show the cartoon on the front end. I bet that was great on the tape, right? Nice musical accompaniment, no words. Made by the United Nations, and available to people in many languages. By not having gotten into English, the only English there really was the big if. And I suppose somebody translates at that point.
People of a number of nationalities work on it, you know?
Don't know the origins of it. I know we had a heck of a time getting it. It set us back about 2 months in terms of preparing a video for this year's legislative focus on the peace dividend. I guess it's pretty obvious, you know, the possibilities. It's too high-tech, I know, for Al Pitcher. I suspect he hasn't seen it, I think, but, you know, it pictures a modern, urban, still fairly technological society, which is what I think we're dealing with for the next 100 years. Now, in the 500-year plan or the 1,000-year plan, I think we can talk about something altogether different. And I think that's great that people are working on the 1,000-year plan. There always has to be somebody working on the 1,000-year plan. But for most people, I think this is more close to what reality is today, tomorrow, next week, next month, next 10 years, next 50 years, and the next 100 years, if we don't either annihilate ourselves in nuclear war. Clearly, the nuclear war is the greatest threat to the environment that exists, much more so than anything else, or through other environmental things that completely annihilate the possibilities for human and natural life on this planet. Not that human life isn't natural. I have a lot to learn about. I have a lot to learn about how to change my language on environmental stuff. That's a whole new thing for me. It's new as of this week, so that's going to take the same kind of work that changing my language on sexism and so forth has taken, which in that case I've been working at it 15 years and I still go wrong. So anyhow, my overall claim, I'm going to mainly talk about the issue and we can dialogue and so forth, and I'm hoping this time we will write a letter. We didn't yesterday. When I say public policy is a spiritual discipline, what I think I'm saying is something like, you know, you think of the discipline of weight loss, you think of the discipline of exercise, you think of the discipline of giving up something. You think of spiritual disciplines as structured prayer, setting aside a time for prayer each morning, you know, a time for meditation, a time to be at peace, a time to talk with God, or even, you know, whole weekends that are structured. The spiritual exercises of Ignatius Loyola that the Jesuits have to go through as part of their training is a highly structured, long, very intensive, really magnificent process in its own way. I've sometimes been jealous of their having gone through that, and yet I guess I don't myself or volunteer to go through it. I guess one of these days maybe I will. It's a highly disciplined process. I guess what I want to say is that public policy is a highly disciplined process too. Okay? That the scale of the things we're working with, some of you were here Monday night in the forum, and I was talking, you know, we're not talking here about, you know, a few cans of this or a few bottles of that. We're talking about millions dropping this way, 10 minutes later, millions dropping that way. We're talking about big institutions that make big decisions over the long haul. Washington, D.C. and New York City are more powerful than Rome could ever imagine. More powerful. They shape our lives enormously. The taxes you pay, the quality of your roads, the quality of your schools, all the things that shape your life, the quality of your food, are all shaped by government policies, either at the local level or the national level. Clearly, if there were a nuclear war, that becomes the biggest factor in human life. It becomes a whole lot more important than, you know, whether I get my next promotion or whether my kids are wearing the right clothes to school, or, you know, the things that ordinarily, you know, do the curtains match each other? Do the towels match each other? Do they match the shower curtain? The things that ordinarily consume our daily lives are things of fairly small magnitude compared with this really, really big stuff. By the same token, if you make a change at that level, the scale of the change is magnificent. Now, it never gets clean. You're never going to get what you want. Someone said yesterday, politics, when someone said compromise was one of the words that came up. You betcha. You're not going to get the perfect society through the political process in any short period of time, because there's always trade-offs. You know, there's always this group versus that group. And you're not gonna, it's always gonna be ambiguous, it's always gonna be mixed, and you gotta learn to live in the midst of ambiguity and forget a lot of these idealized images. They're nice visions, they're good to have somewhere, but don't pretend they're very terribly real. The reality of things is always mixed and ambiguous and dirty and clean at the same time. But when you get a benefit, it is magnificent. Not too long ago, as I'm repeating myself a bit here, one of the things I'm having trouble getting hold of in this series here at Holden is that people that are here one day aren't here the next day. So I think, well, I explained what Bread for the World is, and then someone doesn't know, and I say, oh, gosh, that's right. Of course they don't. You know, I don't go to all the sessions either. And so in my head, I'm assuming continuity over 10 days here. You know, on Friday, a week from now, I'm going to talk about the Horn of Africa. On Thursday, I'm going to talk about South Africa, and maybe one of you will still be here or something like that at that point. And I'm just kind of assuming, you know, this all kind of fits together. And so things I might say on one day, I'm expecting to say something to balance that on another day. But I guess I need to say kind of, well, introductions each day. Anyhow. When you make a change, for example, we worked and worked and worked for a couple of years for some positive policy language on South Africa, or on Africa, not just South Africa, all of Africa. Some language that would talk about sustainable development, some language that talk about debt relief. Third world debt is one of the largest problems facing third world countries. And we worked last year, and we worked and we worked, and there were hearings, and we lobbied, and this and that and the other thing. And the House got a pretty good bill together, and the Senate didn't do anything. They just weren't motivated to act. And so basically nothing happened, and the year ground to a halt, and basically all of our work had come to nothing on that particular set of stuff. All of a sudden, about 6 weeks ago, somebody decided to reopen some of those issues. Some of our staff went down and said, now on third world debt, how about let's put in the word sustainable development in there? How about let's put in a provision for debt relief in there? And the aides said, yeah, you know, we weren't thinking about sustainable development, but you're right. We ought to require that all the projects that the U.S. helps funds be projects that are ecologically, sustainable. I think in-house the word that Bread for the World is going with is renewable rather than sustainable, because sustainable is not big enough. You don't want to just sustain it. You want the earth to be self-renewing. But sustainable is a word that people understand in Congress, and renewable kind of eludes them at this point. It's not enough in vogue that they know exactly what you're talking about. And all of a sudden that stuff is in the bill, stuff we worked for last year. Will the bill get passed? I don't know. Ask me at the end of the congressional session. But if that bill gets passed, 15 or 20 words, or maybe three sentences, in one bill, way down here in the fifth part of the 34th part, will change the way third world countries experience U.S. grant and loan programs. And it won't change it overnight, but it will make a difference. It really will make a difference. out there for people that we'll never meet. They'll never know that we existed. You know, it's that kind of anonymous community of faith that works for justice that are not known to each other. And there are people out there that'll just know that life got better somehow because somebody somewhere did something. And probably think it was a Congress initiating on its own. And of course, you can't do it without Congress. So the scale is such that the work is hard. It takes a lot of discipline. The labor is great. The benefits are great. Second thing I would say is the complexity. It's a discipline because it's a very complex system. And it just takes a lot of sitting down and doing drudge work. I mean sitting down and reading bills and reading hearings. Now, you don't have to do all that kind of stuff. There are organizations that will do it for you, condense it for you, prepare it for you, and all that. And if you trust the organization, by and large, you can go with that. Or you can be invited to read the stuff yourself and become expert in one issue, say, or two. That's great, you know, if you have the time and energy to. It takes a lot of work. These are complicated kind of things. And sometimes what looks like a good program is a bad program. For example, U.S. food aid. We would all kind of say, oh yeah, that's great. You know, we have all this grain and we ship it to third world countries. Isn't that wonderful? Well, some of food aid helps people and some food aid hurts people. Some U.S. food aid is destructive to poor people in third world countries, flat out. So we are spending tax dollars in some cases to hurt third world people, to make their situation worse. Well, you know, if you just say food aid, oh yeah, great. Well, you have to kind of get down into it a little bit and see how it actually hits, you know, at ground level, how it actually affects people in third. How does it hurt them? Well, for example, emergency food aid is good. Long-term food aid tends to go to governments that are ideologically aligned with us, militarily aligned with us. Long-term food aid, sometimes different governments, we send it to these governments and they handle it in different ways. So this is not, there's no blanket statement that covers all of them. But for example, some of them will sell or distribute U.S. food products so cheaply that your local peasant farmer cannot compete with them and is driven off the land. They cannot compete with those low prices. And so people who once were better able to feed themselves become less able to feed themselves just because of the economics of the thing. A large chunk of U.S. food aid is a federal marketing strategy. It is designed not to feed people. It is designed to create markets for U.S. food products. That is, your tax dollars are subsidizing a marketing strategy for private industries that will, if these people come to like our stuff, like we've come to like their stuff, kiwi fruit and, you know, the various things that we didn't used to have that we get from some other countries. If they come to like grain instead of rice, if they become to like, you know, white bread, as it were, which is very popular in some places now, if they come to like white bread and give up brown rice, then we've created an enormous market. All those billions of people out there, you know, that become for a long period, this is big time, long term stuff, they become a market for U.S. grain products. And so we're going to be able to further profit off the third world, because we've created a need, quote, a need, or at least a desire, a market for certain kinds of U.S. products. I would also say that public policy is a spiritual discipline because, I just have people sit down and write letters, make phone calls. We're not talking here about something. We're talking about organized, grassroots, political activity. I should have said, what is Bread for the World? We lobby. We don't feed anyone. We don't have feeding programs. We don't have trucks. We don't have granaries. We don't go places to feed people. We don't show them how to dig wells. Lutheran World Relief does that. Catholic Relief Services does that. Church World Service does that. They do a good job. We're not competing with what they do. We're working on changing U.S. policy toward these places, toward domestic hunger and international hunger. So all we do is lobby. But it's a, honest to goodness, it's a real pain in the butt to have to sit down and write a letter. or to form a local group and get people motivated to come. You know, someone comes to me yesterday and says, how do I get people going in my church? I am really discouraged, you know. Well, it's work. It takes a discipline. It takes hanging in there. It takes believing that something will happen even when you can't see anything happening. So I would say that public policy is a spiritual discipline in that sense, and it's also a spiritual discipline in the sense that it enlarges the arena of the good, or God, if you will. To a hungry person, a crust of bread is God at that moment. And the ecstasy of eating and drinking, when you have not eaten and drinking, right? When you have not eaten or drunk. Huh. That word demands a little rethinking in our language system, because it makes drunk an innocuous word, doesn't it?
Huh. Anything to drink.
I had never thought about that, or have not had anything to drink. The ecstasy of eating or drinking when you have not had either is an ecstasy. It is a spiritual ecstasy. I mean, is there anything more basic, you know? I think there's all kinds of spiritual experiences in the midst of daily life that we don't recognize, okay? And that's kind of my core principle here that I'm trying to work out. And if you are the person who brings food or changes the policies so that this person can eat or drink, you are God to that person in that act. Yesterday I stated a lot of things negatively. I'm going to make just one negative statement today. God, the God we traditionally talk about in churches, doesn't even deliver pizza. Okay? Can't deliver pizza, is incapable of the simplest kind of act. People, now you can say God in those people, the God of those people, Spirit of God in those people, there's a lot of different ways of saying it, and you know, I can live with a lot of them. But the point is that the food gets delivered, okay? And it doesn't happen. The absolute bottom line is, it ain't going to happen if we don't do it. We're it, folks. So you, as a part of God, or as a God part, can make a difference. I put some stuff up here. For example, but this is long term. Somebody said at the forum Monday night, someone looked a little depressed after we said how hard all this stuff is and how big it is, and they said, but can't we do anything, you know? Well, I took out the statistical abstract a while back and looked at 1870 to 1900. Sometimes you have to take the long view. These are big, big things here. You know, someone says, oh gosh, I worked real hard in the peace movement for 6 months or 2 years and we didn't get out of Vietnam. Well, it took 10 years or 12 or 15 years, but by golly, we got out, you know? This stuff doesn't happen overnight. We have very unreal expectations, I think, about speed. We think everything, you know, it's the fast food mentality of American culture. If it can't happen real soon, it somehow is invalid. In 1870, 48% of the U.S., of the children of school age in the United States were in school. In 1970, 90.6% of school age children in the United States were in school. Black children in 1870, 9.9% were in school. In 1970, 89.4% of black children of school age were in school. In 1870, I mean, we're so out of touch with what 100 years can bring. I mean, that to me is one of the most startling figures up here, okay? In 1870, 2%. If you were a high school graduate in 1870, you were the creme de la creme of American culture, okay? And we don't even talk about college, you know? I mean, the percentages get even more dramatic. 2% of Americans were high school graduates in 1870. In 1970, 75.6%. In 1870, there was not a single acre of national park land in the United States, and that's one of the reasons I chose 1870 to 1970, because Yellowstone was started in 1872. In 1970, there were 35 national parks with 14 million acres. Now you could say, and rightly so, well, there still aren't enough parks, they aren't well enough cared for. I mean, it's not that the promised land came in 1970, okay? I'm just trying to say that there's a difference. There is a difference, that something does happen over time. I have four kids. The youngest one is black. 130 years ago, he would have been a slave. 25 years ago, the university I taught in was segregated. 70 years ago, neither of my daughters could have voted in a national election, nor in most states, although in some states. I think Wyoming in particular. Nor could they have run for office because they weren't enfranchised, nor could they have served on juries because juries were composed of people who were on the voting roster in most states. Again, the rules varied from state to state. 70 years is not so very long. I mean, there's lots of people around. You know, I'm sure there are people in Holden Village right now, people all over, who were alive when women couldn't vote. That's not very long in the whole scheme of things. It's longer than it takes to get a Big Mac, but it's not very long in the whole scheme of things. Life expectancy in 1900 was 47.3 years. For males in the United States. In 1970, it was 70.9. For black males in the United States, life expectancy was 33 years in 1900. 65.9 years in 1970, and still a gap, a significant gap here. Most of them dying on the young side, actually, dying in drug stuff and inner city crime and violence and so forth. Maternal mortality, that is to say, women who die in childbirth, among white women in 1900, I've switched years now, this is no longer 1870. In 1900, 60.8 white women died in childbirth per 10,000 live births. It was 1.4% in 1970. Now that's still not good. In terms of infant mortality, the United States is 17th among the developed nations of the world. We are way down there in terms of infant mortality today. But, again, the promised land is not here. But my gosh, what a difference, you know? For blacks, per 10,000 live births, infant or maternal mortality, for blacks, 117.9 per 10,000 live births was 5.6. in 1970. Food safety. You think what's happened in food safety in 100 years. If you've never read Upton Sinclair's The Jungle, it's a kind of engaging, it's a novel, it's not, you know, it's not like most of the stuff you have to read to get through this, the kind of dry sociology and economics and politics kind of stuff, which on the whole is not too exciting. But he, in The Jungle, he describes the period about 100 years ago. He was a reformer, a muckraker. A period of, I think it's about late 1800s, early 1900s, when there were no food safety laws, okay? And that meant that if you had a sausage, it could have cancerous chicken in it, and it routinely did. There was no regulation. There was no Food and Drug Administration. You could buy medication. There was no guarantee what was in that medication at all. None. Because there was no regulation of any kind. There were no labor laws. I've seen a few films of children coming out of factories, little kids, you know, 100 years ago. No child labor laws. No labor laws of any kind. People working in humane conditions. You know, totally inhumane conditions, working, you know, 15, 16 hours a day, little kids and so forth. That's within the last 100 years. Environmental concerns. I mean, I know pitcher's right, you know, we've got an enormous way to go on that stuff. But looked at the other way, we've come a long way in the last 20 years. 20 years ago, nobody was worried about you know, picking up nuclear waste and taking tailings out of a mine, or there was no, you know, Environmental Protection Agency. There was no large public concern. We have come a very long way. We have an enormous long way to go. I'm not trying to minimize that at all. The way we have to go is larger than the distance we've come, for sure, by a good part. Nonetheless, there has been change. Now let me just read a bit here, a page or two. These benefits that we take so much for granted were made possible, and this is what I'm trying to say with all these stuff, by the hard labors and public policy efforts of preceding generations, the community of the faithful. We always hear the names of the Nobel Prize winners, Jane Addams, the Red Cross, Amnesty International, people like Albert Schweitzer, Martin Luther King Jr., Bishop Oscar Romero, but most of those who worked for peace and justice did not win any kind of prize nor get any kind of merit badge. They were not Nobels, they were nobodies. And their names would fill phone books that would stack up probably to the ceiling of this room, but the pages would be empty because we haven't the vaguest idea who most of them were. They were people that worked on school boards. They were people that worked in bureaucracies that day after day ground out the hardcore stuff that it takes to get a national park. I mean, how many, the beaches of Anzio where American soldiers died in World War II for freedom. How many people can you actually name who died on the beaches of Anzio or of any of the other major battlefields, say of World War II? Can you tell me the names of the Buddhist monks who burned themselves alive 15 years ago to protest the inhumanity of the war in Vietnam? You may remember one at best. I don't know their names, and I've seen their names. I've seen stuff about them, but I don't remember their names. They, like many others, died for the sins of history. Martin Luther King Jr. died for the sins of history. And it's not so important that we remember their names. My name, you know, I'm a nobody. Nobody's going to remember my name a very short time. My kids will remember, and after my kids die, that'll pretty much be it. It'll just be a name somewhere. But it's not important that my name be remembered, nor is it important that we be a somebody, but it is important that we participate in that community of the faithful who over the centuries have made those schools, who have taught those kids, who have created those parks, who have worked to eliminate slavery, who have, women worked in the 1860s, women were told, first the slaves and then the women. They wanted the vote, they said first, as though there were no black women, but anyhow. So first the slaves and then the women. So then you get the emancipation of the slaves, they get the ability, black men get the right to vote, and then the women's agenda disappeared from the active concern of public policy. Now there were always women working on it. I'm not saying it wasn't there, and very strong women doing some very dramatic and wonderful things. But as a national kind of public policy impetus, it kind of disappeared from sight in the Reconstruction period. And so it was another 60 years of labor, 60 years of suffrage work, 60 years of people doing do-diddly little stuff and marching and writing letters and doing all the stuff that Susan B. Anthony did and others did. 60 years to get the vote from the point at which, from that particular point. Their examples remind us, and this is what I think, you know, these are pieces of salvation. We like to use the word salvation in a kind of ethereal sense, but this is real hardcore salvation. When you're hungry, food is at least for that moment a piece of salvation. These examples remind us that people can change history, that our efforts do contribute good to the larger whole, that the future need not be an extension of the cruel inhumanity and precarious struggle that has characterized the past. Life comes to us as a gift. It comes to us as a gift. You can say, as a gift of God, that's fine. I didn't make this building. I didn't do this fireplace, you know. I didn't put that wood together, nor cut it down. I didn't invent language. I didn't make these clothes, nor did I invent zippers or Velcro or any of that stuff. Where did all that stuff come from? It's a gift from the prior generations. It's a gift from the people who have been here before us. They have left behind their gifts, and we are the beneficiaries of their gifts. And it is our task to take the gift in a sort of, if you will, I hope this is, take the gift as a sort of marathon or a sort of relay race, if you will, to receive the gift from the runners before us, to improve the gift, and to hand it on to the next group of runners on the track of life today. We hear a lot in Christian circles, religious circles, about the good news. The good news. What is really the good news? The best good news in the last year has been the fall of the Berlin Wall and what's going on. Now there's good news. It's not some kind of numinous thing that floats around somewhere and happens to light here and there once in a while. We're talking about real hardcore good news for millions of people. Really good news would be that there weren't any nuclear weapons anymore. Let's notch it up one step. Now that would be wonderful. I mean, how good I felt about the Europe thing, you know? I hadn't felt so good about anything in public policy since I don't know when, you know? I didn't think, most of us didn't think we'd live to see something like that. And there it is. That's good news. Why did it happen? Because people continued to hammer away, because people continued to knit and weave, because people continued to work to make it happen. That's the only way it happens, and that's what made it happen. So the good news is that we have eliminated the threat of nuclear annihilation, that the hungry are being fed, that the poor are lifted out of the worst ravages of their poverty, that the homeless have a home, as in the videotape. Stewardship, as you know, has to do with care of the earth and one another as part of the earth. Baptism is initiation into the community of those who have decided to make the good news real in history, where you can touch it and feel it and smell it and lean against it and so forth. And communion is the affirmation and celebration of our common humanity across the lines of nationality and ideology. So, for that as introduction. Harvest of Peace. I have a number of pieces here, which you are welcome to have if you wish. You can pass this around if you want one. This is a little piece I wrote on the peace dividend. I have probably enough if you wish one. Don't take anything you don't want, you know, just to leave it laying around or discard somewhere. If you don't want it, just hand it back or something, or leave it in the pile and I'll haul it on with me and get it to someone else. In addition, when you leave, if you want, here is one of the newsletters I handed out Monday, an extra copy. Here's a thing on churches and hunger. Here's a thing on members of Congress, what committees they're on. Here is a membership-oriented piece. But this piece I want you for sure to have at least right now. I want you to hold this one in your hand, even if you don't want to keep it. The peace dividend and the budget. Well, what's been going on is, as you know, read your newspaper, and with that bus comes probably Saturday and Sunday's New York Times, which will be nice. As you know, the federal deficit has been growing enormously. Why has the federal deficit been growing? Anybody care to venture a word on that?
Military. Is that spending more than we're taking in?
Spending more than we're taking in? What are we spending it on?
Weapons.
I heard people at once, so I didn't hear anybody. What?
Weapons.
The
military. The whole system.
Military system. Yeah, and
interest
payment.
That's right.
As I've gotten into some of this, just begun to get into some of these issues, it's pretty mind-boggling complicated, and I don't pretend to be any kind of expert in this stuff, you know. I know a little bit about it because I focused on it a bit, but when Mr. Reagan took office, the federal deficit was $914 billion. Let's see, I don't know if I can do this. That's hundreds, thousands, millions. Is that right?
Yeah.
Hundreds, thousands, millions, billions. I mean, we don't even, and I think it's very deceptive to go,
914B.
Because all, you know, the magnitude of what we're talking about here kind of disappears into the B, you know. Because 914T is 914 trillion. Well, hey, that's another whole set of zeros over here. Be that as it may. When he took office, the federal deficit was $914 billion. If you took a stack of $1,000 bills,
yeah, okay.
What?
We're just wondering what a $1,000 bill looked like.
Yeah, right. So, I started with a wrong if, didn't I? Yeah. The next time you have a stack of $1,000 bills in your hand, stack them up, lay them on top of each other, and you'll find that when you get to 914 billion, that it's a stack 58 miles high. 58 miles high. Okay? When Mr. Reagan left office, the federal deficit was $2.6 trillion after the biggest spending spree in American history. A spending spree in which, and I made this and then I went back there and looked at it and realized you can't see it very well anyhow. But it's in the blueprint for social justice. I just took it out of that. If you want to look at the graph in there, a little closer at hand. 10 years, 1980 to 1990, military spending went up 37%. Low-income housing went down 74%. Why are there so many people on the streets? That's one of the reasons. Low-income spending on low-income housing went down 74% in those 10 years. Low-income employment services, things that help people get jobs, you know, funding went down 67%. Low-income energy assistance went down 47%. Military spending went up 37%. Social service block grants, child care, elder care, stuff like that, went down 35%. Native American education went down 28%. Migrant health went down 20%. Maternal and child health, money for maternal and child health programs went down 14%. A lot, though not all, of that deficit, it's really due pretty much to three things. Military spending, the interest payments on the deficit, and entitlement programs. Okay, today the federal deficit is approximately $3 trillion. That's when Reagan left office. Let's see, 500,000 million days. Today the federal deficit is roughly $3 trillion, which would be a stack of $1,000 bills 201 miles high. Now, you remember we're laying those bills flat on each other. We're not stacking them up end to end here. There's no kind of tricky thing here. One of the things that Bread for the World is working on this year is the Harvest of Peace resolution. Resolution's on the back of this bulletin insert, and that's why I want you to have it in your hand. In the light of the changes that are occurring in Eastern Europe, you know, one of the funny things about some of this stuff, you can call it grace or you can call it luck, but we decided to do this last July before the Berlin Wall came down and before all this stuff happened in Europe. I mean, I'm just kind of amazed. Last July, we were sitting around in staff meetings saying, no way the churches will buy this. You know, we can't do this. They're not ready for this. This is going to be too much hassle. And then all this other stuff happened, and people were saying, well, yeah, that makes sense to me, you know? Except they're still worried about the local plant. But anyhow, because we wrote this in our shop, that is to say, we wrote this resolution in-house, we got somebody to put it in readable form for us, get it down to one page. We found a senator and a representative to introduce it in Congress. We found a, which way was it? We found Mark Hatfield, a senator, Republican from Oregon, to introduce it into the Senate, and a Democrat, Matt McHugh, to introduce it in the House. And as soon as we had a Republican in the Senate, we went out and found a Democrat to co-sponsor it. And as soon as we had a Democrat in the House, we went out to find a Republican to co-sponsor it. Because these are not finally partisan issues. People who are concerned about hunger and justice do not all live in one political party. They just don't. And that's just the way it is. Just factually, that's the way it is. And besides, if you're going to win, you can't be partisan, finally. If you're going to convince Congress, you have to convince both sides of the House. So both for practical reasons, but just plain empirically true. Because of the reduction in tensions between the East-West, now I'm sort of starting at the top of the resolution and gradually kind of scatting down paragraph to paragraph, there's an opportunity to reverse the $1 trillion arms race and promote peaceful development. Hunger victimizes about 20 million people in the United States and 1 billion people worldwide. And the third whereas has to do with security. We have learned to define security in terms of our military preparedness. I mean, the word security to most of us at an at-home level means I got enough food, I got warm clothing, I got a roof over my head, things are okay with my family, you know, siblings, kids, whatever, you know. And that's security. That's real security, you know. Well, we need to redefine security and not think in terms of how many weapons do we have, that therefore we have security, but, you know, how could we make the kind of world in which everybody's got a roof over their head when it rains and there's food on the table and so forth. So, it is the sense of Congress that the United States to help receive common security by reducing the world's reliance on military and redirecting resources toward peaceful efforts for overcoming hunger, poverty, and meeting basic human needs by, one, negotiating verifiable treaties such that by the year 2000, world military expenditures would be cut in half. That is a big challenge, and not many members of Congress are ready for that. Yeah?
What's the $1 trillion mean up in the first paragraph? Why was that the figure chosen? I'm trying to connect that to the number one.
To number one. I'm not sure.
They're fuzzy.
Okay.
$1 trillion arms race, what per period of what, for what period?
$1 trillion, okay. That's a good question. What is it? $1 trillion per year globally is what, I think that's correct.
Not U.S.?
No, not the U.S. The U.S. military budget's around 200, that's what they're arguing about right now, it's 203 billion, roughly. That's the argument is right now, how big will it be next year? 197, 203, $206 billion, something like that. $1 trillion is the world military expenditures this year, worldwide, globally.
That sounds small, though, compared to
our deficit.
The debt, yeah.
Well, yeah, it's still more than it needs to be, however. Per year. That's per year,
yeah,
right.
That's a national debt over many
years. That's a national debt.
Though. We're talking 1 year.
That's right. We're talking about third world countries who are cutting back on schools and health care so they can have modern military weapons. So they can, you know, where do they get these modern military weapons? They buy them from our factories.
We're doing that to our own schools.
That's right, and we're doing that to our own schools.
Mm-hmm.
We can relatively afford it better than they can, but it's not good in either case. Yeah. So, a reduction of military expenditures by half by the year 2000. Two, reducing military assistance and arms sales to developing nations. See, we've got this kind of ongoing proxy. All of the military conflicts in the world since World War II, except when Russia came rolling into Czechoslovakia and Poland, but all of the other military conflicts since World War II have occurred in third world nations, in developing nations. It's their land that's been burned. It's they who are being encouraged to buy weapons to fight each other. You've all heard this figure somewhere else, I'm sure. But we are spending $1.4 million every single day in El Salvador. We are sending the government El Salvador $1.4 million every single day. Most of that goes for weapons and military forces. Curiously, we are now the major arms supplier to both sides of the conflict. How can we be supplier to both sides? Well, one way is that you've got this, you know, this guy or this woman, maybe. I don't know whether El Salvador has women in
there. There are a lot of women
In the military there?
Among the rebels,
yeah. Say you've got an army, bottom of the line, you know, whatever, private, first class, or whatever it may be in their military structure, got a weapon. Very poor. A family out there doesn't have enough to eat. Well, you lose your weapon. Right? Or it gets taken from you, or it gets stolen. What it means is you sold your weapon onto a black market, and the rebels go buy the weapons. And so, and the other way we supply them is we establish it, we send weapons, and there's this little outpost, and the rebels overrun the outpost, they take all the weapons. So now we're supplying the weapons for both sides of the conflict. We're sending $1.4 million every day to El Salvador. And what's happening in El Salvador? Schools are closing. Infant mortality rates are rising. Poverty is rising. Your basic poor person in El Salvador is now considerably worse off for all the money we have sent than they were before. So that's an example where sometimes we go for increased money. This is an example where we want less money. Save some money. You know, give each American citizen $1.4 million every day until we are something, you know, or a quarter of a million. I mean, let's just pass it around or whatever. But find some more productive way to spend that money. So we want reduced military assistance and arms sales to developing nations. The largest recipients of U.S. military and security aid are Israel and Egypt. And again, that's kind of peculiar in a sense because they each get close to $2 billion. Israel gets the most, Egypt gets the second most. Each gets about $2 billion, and I don't know what that factors out to on a daily basis, but that's many million dollars a day. So even that's not primarily going to, you know, your really underdeveloped countries. Egypt to some extent is. Three, encouraging peaceful settlement of conflict through regional international negotiations. Four, providing increased assistance to developing nations to overcome hunger and poverty, to reduce debt, promote human rights, people's participation in political decisions, and ensure sustainable development and protect the environment. This is where that money should go. This is where that, you know, in the film, take the money from the military spending and put it into environment and people and democracy and debt alleviation. Support domestically for programs that address human needs. Military conversion, very popular. It's one of our foci. It will not be a central focus because, frankly, we cut along our criterion as the poorest of the poor. And military conversion is not a program for the poorest of the poor. It's a program for middle and upper middle class people, by and large. People who are highly skilled technicians, who have skills, who have incomes. We will support it, we will work for it, but we won't work our tail off for it because other people, middle class people, will rise to support that anyhow. And so we focus on things where you have to generate it because poor people aren't going to generate it if somebody doesn't generate this stuff for them, at least by and large. So, and then what we do with this is it's introduced in Congress. There are about 110 members of Congress have signed on in the House, about 14 in the Senate, last I heard. We produce a kit that can be used, talks about world military expenditures. It has a fact sheet. It gives the resolution. It gives questions and answers. This is what's produced for a little theology section that I wrote on. It's real interesting. I went back and reread that section where Jesus says, what is that quote about going out into the world and make disciples of all nations? No, not that one. Oh, shoot. It's in Matthew. It's also in Matthew, but it's one of the earlier passages. Can't think. It's a passage in about the good news. And if you read the whole chapter, it's the passage where they always use for evangelism. Go out and bring disciples in to the harvest. That's it. It's the harvest passage. The harvest is ripe, but the laborers, if you pray that the Lord of the harvest will send laborers. Guys, come back and read the whole chapter. And what's it about? It's not about evangelism. It's about, the whole chapter is about Jesus healing people, driving out evil spirits, bringing someone who's dead alive. The whole passage is about, hey, we got so much social justice and mercy work to do here that I can't do it all by myself. I'm Jesus, but I can't do it all by myself. And so we need to recruit you other people to get out there and do this stuff because there's more of it than I can handle. When I went back and reread, I was kind of startled when I saw the context because I grew up with a completely different interpretation of that passage. Anyhow, this assumes that you've got to teach an adult class in Sunday school and you don't know anything about any of this and you're starting from absolute zero. And so it's a kind of how to put together an offering of letters, an annual thing in which a congregation will write letters to Congress. We can generate 100,000 letters on something like this. We can influence Congress. We can change the way Congress does business. We can make a more humane and just world, but it takes immense political clout to do that. Okay? It takes marshaling large forces to do that. So we have congregations where people write letters. They take them forward. They dedicate them at the altar. Or they write them after church or between masses or in Sunday school classes or in women's groups. Anywhere, 5 letters. 5 letters is great, you know. 500 letters in some churches. That's wonderful. Campuses. Grambling. Grambling wrote, people at Grambling stood in line to write letters this year. Blacks understand that politics and faith are connected and that you need to change structures in order to make things happen. We had 168 letters at Grambling, St. Edward's University in Austin. We had 150 letters or something like that. A poster, worship aids, clip art, and we're out of time. Activities for children and youth, a sample letter. A sample letter to the editor. We generate media work and all that kind of stuff too. I have, since this is a relatively small group, there may be enough of these if you want one, that you could have one. What I would invite you to do is, if you're going to be around, to write a letter. There's a sample letter in here, and just say, Dear Senator So-and-so, if you know your senator's name, say Senate, because we don't have to deal at the moment with who your representative is. If you want to know, I've got a little, the bookstore said that I might mention that there are copies of Up From Apathy in the bookstore if you care to buy one at substantially reduced rates. They're $5.95 in the bookstore, $10.95 from the publisher. If you want to know who your representative is, I got that here, Senator. Write a letter to your senator, because very few senators are signed on, so you're probably pretty safe. They're probably not signed on at this point.